The number you have dialed is not a working number. Please check the number and dial again. Altel 83.
A very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein back with you here along with who is this, Kyle over there?
Yes, I'm here.
And out in Signal Land. It's still Signal Land, right? Yeah. Okay, Signal Land. We have is that Rob T. Firefly there?
It is. Good evening.
And that looks like Gila over to your left.
Good evening.
And do I see Alex?
You're correct. Once again, on a roll, Emmanuel. Good evening.
Wow, this is just like old times. And by old times, I mean at least a month ago, which is the last time we gathered here. Since that time, Kyle and I have been traveling all throughout Europe, talking to so many people, including a good number of our listeners. And it's just, it's great to be back. It was great to be traveling and to be talking with so many of you. And just to be experiencing all kinds of different things. There's so much to share, so much to talk about. I should point out, I just had a tooth extracted, so I'm a little out of it. And the dentist said I shouldn't talk so much. I'm not sure if he was referring to in general or just, you know, because of the medical procedure. But I'm going to, you know, try and fall back a little bit and just try and say what's absolutely vital. But any updates or questions or things that we need to catch up on?
We are interested in hearing about your adventures and travels. And so now that you can't talk as much, that's not as useful a question. Unless Kyle, you want to take the lead on telling us about what you've been up to there.
Well, one of the things that I took away was that. It really has changed in just a little bit of a hiatus for me in traveling. Just some of the ways that it is a little bit easier than I remember it as far as planning and taking care of different logistical parts of being out in the world. And I've definitely been inspired by some of our listeners' travels and getting back out there. It just was really cool to notice how many places are pretty welcoming and generally kind to visitors. Yeah, there's systems, there's different elements of places that can be a little cumbersome and hard to navigate or just don't feel as welcoming. But for me, that reminder of just how welcoming the outside world can be and inviting to just explore and find cool things. And then you get to take it back in the form of stories and adventures that you get to share.
I'd say the only time things seemed unwelcoming was upon arrival, where you weren't sure where you were, or where to go, how it all worked. But then once you got used to that, it became very familiar, very welcoming. And things work, like technology works great. You know, everyone has these contactless cards for mass transit, and it's like the Omni card. You know, it's a universal thing.
Absolutely, contactless payment and just the ease and sort of speed you can transact and go about having your snack or a coffee along the way. It really is kind of amazing how you just don't have to deal with a lot of cumbersome stuff like with cash, and you can pretty well take care of yourself without doing a lot of withdrawing money and exchanging it and trying to keep track of exchange rates. The other thing that I think I really appreciated is there were some countries that we went to that just had ubiquitous access to internet. And I think that's something that has to catch on. There's still this attitude that it's sort of a perk or an extra thing as opposed to being sort of standard and expected. And really everybody needs to access data. And it was just really cool to be in certain places where you check if there's a connection other than like cellular, and it's just there. You're not wandering through accepting a whole bunch of terms and taking different time signing up for things and creating this pattern or this trail of marketing and advertising that you have to agree to. There's none of that in some of the places that I got to visit, and that feeling of like, wow, this is just normal, and your standard of living is that people should have access to, they deserve information, and it helps your overall economy.
Because our home carriers really sucked. They were terrible. They were slow. They were spotty. Oftentimes, we would get absolutely nothing. And you know, every country that I entered, I would get welcomed by my carrier saying, "Hey, if you want true high speed internet, you got to pay more. Otherwise, we're going to limit you to 128K." Which is not exactly feasible for almost anything. But you would just look for Wi-Fi, and you know, if you're on a bus, hey, bus has Wi-Fi, or this train has Wi-Fi. No password, nothing like that. Just it's everywhere, especially places like Estonia. The Baltics were great as far as connectivity. Rob.
One question I have, I think for all three of you guys who have been doing some international traveling at this particular point in world history, have you noticed any difference in the vibes traveling as an American?
I was really worried about that because while I'm a European citizen and I switch to European as soon as I get on the plane, I readily admit I'm from New York. When you say you're from New York, people light up. They really do. And they say, it's my dream to go to New York. Of course, I'll never be allowed to go to New York. So many people say that, too. And these are people who live in Europe, not allowed to come to the United States. You know, if I say I'm from the United States, I'm going to get a look. I know that. But if you say you're from New York, it means something different. It really does. And we didn't get any hostility for where we were from. And you know, we didn't exhibit any hostility towards people because, you know, we're all in this together, and people really look out for each other. You don't have to know the language. You don't have to know the culture. You just have to be open to it. And that's the magic of travel. And this is the first time since before COVID that Kyle and I have been overseas. So it was really important to catch up with a lot of people. And, you know, we went to the Chaos Communication Congress, which is the annual hacker event, takes place in Hamburg. I believe we talked to you on New Year's. And that was, you know, like Mecca for hackers. It's, you know, about 20,000 people show up for this thing. And it's just an incredible display of light and music and technology and just magic. And the thing is, you know, so many people came up to us wanting to know about Hope and the fact that Hope was canceled by St. John's University because there was an anarchist in our midst. We allowed anarchist collectives to be part of the entire conference as attendees, and that was too much for them. And that's why Hope was canceled due to that. And, you know, the number of people who talked to us and paralleled that to what's going on in our country, you know, with all the horrible things. And boy, did we hear a lot of horrible things while we were traveling and occasionally turn on the news. we didn't see it as quickly that, yeah, you know what happened to Hope is very similar to what's happening all across the country. Universities are terrified to have anything resembling free speech these days because they will be targeted. And many of them are simply just lying down and taking it. And it's awful. It's awful for people who want to be able to express themselves. It's awful for people that want to expand their minds. It's awful for people who want to push back. And right now, you know, that's a lot of us who want to push back. And, you know, ever since we got back, which is only a few days ago, wow, it's really gone into hyperdrive. And, you know, I'm super impressed with what I've seen from fellow citizens here in the States. But, you know, I want them to know that the rest of the world, or at least the parts of Europe that we went through, and that's starting in Iceland and going down through the Baltics and Western Europe, they're with us. You know, they support us. They are sending their support, their love. And, you know, we have the ability to inspire them as they inspire us. You know, when we were in... was that Lithuania? I'm sorry, sometimes they merge together. Yeah, Lithuania had the buses that every single bus said, Vilnius loves Ukraine. You know, there were so many shows of support for a country being besieged by another country. And it doesn't stop there. You know, there were all kinds of displays of support for people who were being oppressed or victimized. And that extends to us because guess what? We're those people now too. You know, and we're living in a society where you can be executed in the street now. That is a reality. And it's scary to think that's true. What's even scarier is the possibility that we might think that's normal, that we might start to accept that. And what I'm so happy about is that I'm seeing people aren't accepting it. Driving down the street today, there was a protest at an intersection, just right there, anti-ICE. There was one on Saturday. They're not going away. This time, I don't think they're stopping. And that is inspirational to the world. And I just hope people realize that none of us are alone. None of us are alone. People are watching. People care. People ask us all kinds of questions about what's going on here, about how such a thing is possible. How did we get to this stage? It's hard to explain. It really is hard to explain. But it's something that a lot of us saw coming. And, we have to deal with it. And make no mistake, we have to deal with it. All of us listening. And just know that places like WBAI, who I really hope you support, because can you imagine not having this voice? They are going to be so important in the days, weeks, months, years ahead, as long as we have that amount of time. That's where you will hear different points of view. That's where you will hear what is actually happening. And that's where you will get past the lies, the disinformation that's being spread. I mean, we all saw it last week. We saw how, you know, you could see something with your own eyes and be told that, no, you didn't see that. You know, that used to be just an Orwell saying, but now it's reality. And you need places, you need alternative media, you need individual people to tell you that you're not alone, that we're in this together. And that you're not crazy, you know, that these things are actually happening and we have to find strength in each other and find unity in each other. So I'm not sure if I was answering a question just now, but I felt I had to get that out because I haven't been saying a lot recently. And there is so much going on and we're really at a pivotal point in history. And I just don't want anybody to pass up being a part of that pivotal part of history. Alex, I see your hand is up.
Go ahead. Well, you know, on that very note, I want to mention a few things that I've been up to over the last couple of weeks here, too. I mean, I've been very angry with what's happening with ICE all around the country, especially in New York. And I think what you're speaking to, Emmanuel, I think it strikes a chord with so many people, right? Because you have to do what you can do. It could be joining a protest. It could be making calls. It could be something, but you know, we have to push back in some way or another because this is not—it's not just ICE. It's a coordinated attack on our freedom and our democracy, and in particular this station as well. If you think about how public funding for broadcasting-related issues has been just yanked across the board, I mean, this station and many stations are suffering, And it's more important by the day, by the minute, I think, to have listener-sponsored places like this that give everyone a sense of community and show them that they're not alone. And on that front, I thought I was going to be alone in doing something a couple of weeks ago. I got this email as part of a mailing list I'm on with some NYU folks and whatnot. And it was a request to join in this effort from an NYU law clinic to push back on the ICE detentions that are happening in New York in the five boroughs. And it was a request for people to volunteer and file habeas petitions, basically contesting the right of the federal government to hold these detainees in federal custody, because very often ICE is using the wrong authorities when they detain these people, or they're detaining them under an expanded theory of authorities that is not actually the law. And so in any event, I said to myself, well, you know what? I have to do something. And I'm a lawyer here, and I have this superpower. I have this ability to file these habeas petitions under my own name. So I checked with the founder of the Ethereum Name Service, you know, the entity for which I'm general counsel. And he's over in the UK. And he said, not only do I think, you know, you should be doing this, but I entirely support it. And we can support this financially if you need to. And I showed up for this training for lawyers that volunteered. And I couldn't believe what I saw. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. It was so inspiring to see not just my name and like five other people. There were hundreds of lawyers that volunteered to file these habeas petitions. I mean, the names just kept scrolling and scrolling. These were coming from non-for-profit organizations. They were coming from private law firms. They were coming from in-house. They were coming from all over the place. Everybody was volunteering to get these. And now when these cases come in, they're hard to get because people volunteer so quickly to pick them up. There's more lawyers than there are actual cases and detentions happening right now that are willing. So I feel really good about the fact that my profession is pushing back really hard against ICE right now in New York. And we're going to continue to do so. And I will probably get my first habeas petition within the next week or so to be filing. So something fun, and I'd love to talk further about that on this show as this effort gets underway.
Well, you know, on the subject of ICE and training and all that, you know, to train law enforcement officials takes months, at least. Takes, you know, a number of months. 6 months, perhaps 20 weeks. I don't know. I've seen all kinds of different figures thrown around. And for these ICE agents, who they are literally grabbing from the streets, you know, basically they're looking for MAGA supporters. They're looking for gun rights people. The qualifications are not that high. You don't have to have an education. And they're basically just handing out guns to people and saying, you now have authority. I just read this a little while ago, and I'm still stunned that this is actually what's going on. The training period has been reduced from months down to 47 days. And the reason it's 47 days is because Donald Trump is the goddamn 47th president. You know, this is the kind of childishness they engage in. It's all about numbers and symbols and power, and it doesn't matter about qualifications anymore, you know? They just will take anybody. And we saw in Minneapolis what happens when you have people who don't have a handle on their emotions and don't have proper training and have way too much power. You see what happens there. You see what happens throughout the country when somebody steps up and challenges these people, as everybody has the right to do. Everybody, I think, has the obligation to do. What they are doing is no different than what jackbooted thugs do in places where people are holed up in their houses, trying to live their lives and not be brought to some horrible place that they probably won't survive. You know, and this is not what people voted for. It certainly is not what people voted for. But this is the reality that we're facing right now. So, yeah, people don't want this. People are standing up to it. And, boy, I got to tell you, it is making them mad. It is making them insanely furious. I'm not just talking about the ICE agents. I'm talking about people in the upper echelons of government, because they are becoming increasingly unhinged. And I think that is the best thing to do, is to keep pushing them until they go stark raving mad. And let's not be afraid of the power they have, because don't forget, we gave them that power. We can take it away. And we need to push hard to do that. You know, I've been to a bunch of these demonstrations, and they're great. You know, hundreds, thousands of people. And we're talking about, you know, not very large places. And they're all over the area, all over the country. But, you know, I ask myself, how many people do I know who are basically passionately in favor of these things? Quite a few. How many of them do I know who went to one of these demonstrations? Almost zero. And there's all kinds of reasons why not, and they're valid reasons for sure. But can you imagine if we all showed up, if we spread the word? And, you know, a lot of this also is the way the word gets out. You know, I ask people these demonstrations, how do I find out when the next demonstration is? Oh, you have to join our Facebook group. I'm not on Facebook. I don't give a rat's ass about Facebook. I don't want to be on Facebook. Isn't there a better way to let people know when the next demonstration is? We just need to be more open to new people coming in. And I don't think we have to worry about being disrupted by new people. I think new people are the key. Yes, Gila, go ahead.
I had seen a tweet that went viral about a week ago, and I enjoyed it and just wanted to share it. Cheesecake Factory training is up to 4 weeks. And then even after that, you're still in a probationary period and have to follow lead servers around until they deem you fit enough to drop brown bread by yourself. Just leaving that here for some framing. And that quote tweeted The Atlantic saying ICE agents only receive 47 days of academy training. And that came from a person who's known as Grip Skylark at Tallyberry Baby on Twitter. I moved to New York from the Twin Cities. So this is a very strange moment to be seeing. Seeing people I know talking about it in what's happening in their neighborhoods, what they're seeing as they take their kids to school and try to go to the grocery store, and the way that the community is coming together is heartening. It shouldn't have to be, but it is. Communities are coming together to create mutual support for families who are too scared to go to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Because people are not leaving their homes right now for very, very good reasons. And it's terrifying to see. And that the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security was standing behind a podium that said, "One of ours, all of yours."
Yeah.
That hits something scarily in my gut.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've been saying this a lot over the past few years, but I am so frustrated and so scared and so unsure of what to do other than throw up my hands and hide.
I hear you. And it's difficult. But again, knowing that we're not alone, knowing that there are many people around us, that means the world, especially if you're somebody who's trapped, somebody who feels like they can't even go outside without being grabbed, because either you don't have all the right papers and you're still in the process of filling out all the right forms, or you look like somebody that they might think fits that qualification. It's disgusting. And this is not at all what people, even people on the other side, you know, what they voted for. At least in my mind, the people I know who voted that way would never want something like this. They would want, you know, violent criminals and threats to society. Yeah, take them off the streets. Absolutely. But that's not what's happening. That's not what has been happening over the past year. And it's got to stop. It's got to stop. And if doing everything possible to stop ICE from finishing whatever it is they start, if that's the way to do it, then that's what has to be done. We need trained people, trained law enforcement to carry out law enforcement. You know, people who are qualified to do the job. We don't have that right now. We have a bunch of people who are power hungry and over-weaponized, and they're abusing their power. There are so many videos out there of people who basically are commanded to stop, and then they have their windows broken by these thugs because they didn't stop fast enough, or they didn't stop in the right place. And these are citizens. Not that it should make a difference. You treat everybody with respect. This is one thing you learn traveling, is that people treat each other with respect. You know, you may have nothing in common with them. A totally different background, totally different language. But you treat people right. And that comes back to you. And what's happening now is so ugly, so disgusting, that if we don't fight it, if we don't destroy it, we're going to lose whatever it is that we have here in this country. It will fall apart. And we used to think we were immune from what's going on right now. We are not immune from that. We are not immune from whatever can come about as a result of this. You know, to bring it to technology, you know, I just want to ask this question. How many of you run Windows 95? Be honest. Be honest.
Now?
Yeah, now.
No.
Nobody?
No.
Okay, I'm surprised. Why? All right. I mean, Windows 95 is a good operating system. It worked, you know, connected to the internet and all that, and had programs that worked, and nobody is running Windows 95. Okay.
I don't know. I'm not running it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's kind of honest. All right. Well, okay. I imagine you're not running it because you believe it's outdated, and I guess maybe you've updated to another Windows platform, or maybe you've gone to Ubuntu or something, or, you know, some other Linux distribution. You've upgraded, updated, you've modernized, right? Because that's what you do with systems. You don't leave them as old systems, because they're prone to all kinds of malfunctions, and things get really slow, and there's security issues, and it's just not smart. It's not smart to do that. Sure, you know, you could probably run some programs, but I really wouldn't advise connecting to the internet or to other computers, because, you know, they'll pass you around the campfire like a bag of chips. It's just basically, you know, you will be a victim. It's awful. What will happen to old operating systems? What we have in this country is a very old operating system, and I worry that it's not prepared for what is happening right now. You know, I'm seeing in the news that hey, the Congress is going to vote on the president's a power to invade foreign countries like Venezuela. You know, they're going to do that. This is considered a victory. But, okay, you know, in the unlikely event that it actually passes in the first place, the president can just veto it. He can just say no. So what kind of a system is that? You know, that seems like a very antiquated, outdated system where you need to rein in somebody, and the person you're trying to rein in can simply say, no, I won't be reined in. There's nothing you can do about it. We seem to have this scenario over and over and over again, where this guy can just destroy the White House. He can get rid of public broadcasting. He can do all kinds of things, and nobody can stop him. He can get the Supreme Court to do his bidding, and there's no way around it. It just feels like, you know, if the Founding Fathers had maybe spent a little more time thinking of the possible scenarios out there, we'd have a better operating system. Or maybe we need a way to do some updates every now and then. What do you say, every Tuesday we do an update? You know, just send it out, and it works for computers. I really think it should work for governments, because right now what we have is a very, very broken system. Alex, do you agree? Do you think the system is broken? I know you're into the whole legal system, being a lawyer and all, but you must see that a lot of it is failing.
I do think so. I absolutely do think so. And what's it's really weird that you mentioned this, because my next article that I'm thinking of and already putting the bones together about is here's the working title for it: Democracy as Unpatched Code in a Failing State Machine. Literally, that's the working title of the next article that I'm writing. And I do think there is there's an analogy to be made here, right? Because we have a lot of modern democracies that do seem like they're almost like window dressing in a sense. You think about like today in Brussels, they've gone 600 days without an actual government. It's kind of amazing. Like, so you have to really wonder, like, what is the actual function of modern democracies? And are we confusing uptime, essentially, with something like self-government and self-rule? You know, the fact that these systems just keep trucking along and haven't been rebooted and haven't been taken down and haven't been patched does not necessarily mean that they're great and that they're fit for purpose, right? Like you were trying to make this analogy, you're not running Windows 95 anymore because, you know, you'd be subject to attack. You need to update, you need to upgrade. And so I do think that we have a lot of broken processes, that we need a very serious reboot of democracy and think about how we do this, because to bring this back down to hacker terms again, democracy is just a system. It's a set of rules. It is a system that has certain vulnerabilities in it, and it has certain people exploiting those vulnerabilities in ways that I think we need to patch now. And the systems by which we ordinarily do this, namely the legislative process and the election of officials that we trust to represent the public interest, well, those processes all seem to be in some way or another infected or also being exploited at this particular time as well. And it does seem like, almost from a constitutional perspective, we need to rethink how the system works, how it operates, how we can make it stronger and more resistant to these threat actors that were certainly not anticipated back in the 18th century when the founding fathers were.
Constitutional malware. You can use that, by the way.
Yeah, I can use that, yeah. I mean, it really is crazy that you're mentioning this particular analogy right now, because that was something I actually started writing earlier today. So I guess mediocre minds think alike.
I've heard that said.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, it's a trying time. And, I just hope we all stay alert and awake and involved, because that's the only way it changes.
Yeah, my thought when I was traveling was that, you know, we have a lot of support and interests and ideas, but we have a unique set of circumstances and problems, and we'll have to solve it in only ways we understand in this context. So as a system, it is what we have, and there's quite a bit that needs to be improved long term, but as it stands now, I think it's really just about our own sense of dignity and control as the design of the system dictates with co-equal branches and the like. That system is, I think, lost faith and, or I would say, credibility, and it should be something that we can count on as a sort of guardrail, and that really deteriorates when you have like the kinds of flaws we're seeing in the judiciary and with our representative institutions. It just doesn't seem like they're really that busy with our interests.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that, Kyle. And I think that, you know, we really have to think about how we elect our politicians as well. I mean, there is like, we have a lot of people that are elected that don't necessarily feel like they have a mandate to represent the public interest, because they were never really elected on running for something like the public interest. And so I think in the absence of some kind of watchdogs or you know, robust civic or institutional, you know, equivalence, it's going to be, you know, really difficult for any kind of government, I think, to repair itself here. I think there needs to be more institutional changes. We have to change it, I think, from the outside in. And what I think is really quite fascinating, if you think about the history of our republic going back to the 18th century, these problems that we're having right now do seem to all be entirely unique. And so many of them seem to be born out of the misuse of technology and the misuse of data and the surveillance capitalism economy that we've allowed to be put in place that allows these bad actors, foreign hostile actors as well, to target the polity and manipulate the people in certain ways that were never even imaginable 15 to 20 years ago. And so it's incredible how quickly things can degrade, how quickly this system can degrade and essentially become headless in so many ways. And I think if we don't act quickly to begin to repair it and to patch it, and perhaps it needs some downtime. I don't know if that's necessarily a government shutdown. I don't think that's the kind of downtime that we're talking about, but I think time to think and repair and change some of the democratic processes that we've had in place, because I think we're sliding into an area and a time where it may be difficult to ever get out of this type of quicksand.
There's been some staying power with the protest actions and also, I think, murmurings or just whispers of general strikes and walkouts and things like that, and at least some of the regional actions that are going on in response to the news cycle and the sort of horrific nature of what has been going on with ICE actions. But yeah, we could maybe expect some of that on a larger scale to actually have an impact and be felt, because those are valid forms of action that are really something that are the last form of civil disobedience, I think, that people can really exercise en masse without facing the sorts of repression and authoritarian tactics and basically being cast as rioters or something when you're actually out there voicing your opinion and exercising your First Amendment rights. Because I think after a certain point, you reach a consensus with people that are in an action, and you need to have some other recourse, pick up the demands of people en masse and put that into action.
Yeah, and I you think a lot of people saw that when the folks in Minneapolis were characterized as violent rioters, and everyone saw the videos and knew that that was a lie, and they saw our highest officials just jumping into the lie without any evidence whatsoever within minutes of the incident itself. And I think a lot of eyes were opened at that point. We realized how low they will go and how much they will lie without any shame whatsoever. And meanwhile, characterizing the true rioters of January 6th as heroes, it's just we're living in the upside down. I mean, we really are. There was this piece that I keep seeing on late night TV about Trump appointing himself acting president of Venezuela on Wikipedia. And I was wondering, okay, first of all, how does a person do anything to themselves on Wikipedia? That's not supposed to be the way it works. It turns out that it was a doctored Wikipedia page, which I believe doesn't mean it was an edited Wikipedia page. It was a Wikipedia page that was simply made to look like it was changed when it wasn't. And that page called himself the acting president of Venezuela in a Truth Social post. So basically, he was spreading a lie on a Wikipedia page that did not exist, if I understand that correctly. The way it was being portrayed, though, in the media was that he had somehow changed the Wikipedia page, which I'm sure he believes he has the right to do, but he really doesn't. So did I have that right? I mean, I just had to do some research because it wasn't really being reported anywhere. Rob?
Yeah, anyone can make a Wikipedia page, not only change it to say anything you want and, get your screenshots or whatever, but you don't even have to go that far. If you edit a Wikipedia page, make the changes you want to appear have been made, and then just click preview, you will get that page as if you made those changes to it with no record of you doing so. So, you know, you would be free and clear to take screenshots and spread them around and do whatever you liked. But as opposed to if you actually edit a Wikipedia page and there's a log of your user account or your IP address or whatever, and also a digital screenshot is eminently alterable to say whatever you want in any case. So, yeah, it's easy to fake.
So there's no record because you didn't actually do it. And if you did do it, you'd be set upon immediately by a whole bunch of Wikipedia editors who would quickly fix whatever it is you were trying to pull off.
So, yes, because there are crack Wikipedians out there who are very good, and Wikipedia has been so amazingly excellent at beating back the tide of biased and fake edits and things like that. It is really a triumph in terms of community-led projects, unlike so many out there. It is a shining beacon in the world of projects like this, where people who are actually there just to make it the best reference site that they can make keep it that way.
We need to recognize their contributions and the amazing value that they add to everything, really. And there are so many journalist outlets that get it wrong, that basically bow down to the pressure. We're seeing that everywhere in the corporate media, which is why the corporate media was always a bad idea. And, you know, we've railed against that for decades. Having massive corporations take over newspapers doesn't work out well. And we're seeing the proof every single day. So that's something to keep in mind. And of course, you know, you can always start another paper. You can always, get more people involved and fight back against this simply by telling the truth. Okay, we have a letter I'd like to read. Our email address is oth@2600.com. Hi, all. Hope your new year is off to a good start. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, we're fine, but boy, everything around us is falling apart. But thanks. Thanks for the good thoughts. I'm looking forward to hearing many more great off-the-hook shows this year. Well, we will see. I hope Emmanuel and Kyle have made it back safely to the U.S. from CCC, as well as Alex from the fancy dress party in London. Yes, I hope he enjoyed that too. I would really like to hear their and the rest of the crew's perspective on the attack that Martha Root performed live at CCC that is making the rounds. This is from Frank. And, you know, that's an interesting question because Kyle and I were at CCC, the Chaos Communication Congress in Hamburg, this Martha Root talk, somehow we missed that. There were so many talks. There really were tons of them. So it's not hard to miss things. But we didn't find out about this until days afterwards. But basically, Martha Root, from what I understand, hacked some kind of a dating site for white supremacists live on stage and was able to reveal the identities of their entire user base. I'm not sure I have that totally right. You're waving your hand frantically, Alex. So what, go ahead, correct me.
I'm going to pass it over to Rob to explain the urgency here.
Yeah, because we read this letter and talked about this story last week when you Emmanuel and Kyle were not with us. The story was amazing, and there's been this huge reaction to it. But you know, we did go into depth on what happened and how it happened, and but there has been there since last week's show, there has been an interesting update to it, a story from the 11th from the Observer in the UK. A couple of those leaked white supremacist dating site profiles have been linked to Tory and Reform councillors. A conservative councillor, that's a member of representative government over there, has been suspended after her account was included on a leaked user list from one of the sites. So, the Pink Power Ranger performed this great act of superheroism at CCC, and our friends at DDoS Secrets were hosting some of the material, not putting it all out into the public, but making it available to researchers and journalists who requested it for, you know, proper reasons. And this story appears to be the result of that. The people found by the Observer in the database, this from the story here, appear to include an ex-member of the British National Party, activists within the neo-Nazi group Patriotic Alternative, and a man who ran for political office for Britain First. Also listed is Lilith Osborne, a former teacher and conservative counselor in Glastonbury, Somerset. And when she joined the pro-white dating site before she was elected, she described her political orientation as pro-white and said she was seeking a partner interested in indigenous European spirituality. So yeah, there has been fallout from this amazing move on the part of the Pink Power Ranger over there in Germany.
So I know that whenever something like this happens, there are questions raised about privacy, about doxing people and things like that. Where is the line? Because if I got a list of everybody who voted MAGA, I don't think it would be appropriate to release that list. But we're talking about people who are overtly white supremacist here. And I believe that's the difference, is it?
I think that's a part of it. But also these people who are in government, who are in public service, and as such need to be prepared for the level of accountability that comes with that sort of work, theoretically. We're not seeing that always the case, at least in this country. But these people who were in positions of power in the UK, who on the down low were on a neo-Nazi dating app, I think that's worth knowing. That knowledge is worth spreading out there. And at least one politician seems to have lost their job as a result.
Well, if it's on the down low, they're going onto this white supremacist site and entering their real name. So how much on the down low is it actually?
Well, I think that's also part of what the presentation included, was that part of it was that the security and the practices, the
OPSEC.
Thank you. Were so small. It was terrible. And the fact that Martha Root was able to set up an AI chatbot, lure in users and get them to identify a bunch of information about themselves. The sites that got wiped are so gross. Sites, plural. Mm-hmm. And this whole story is fascinating. We did talk about it a lot last week, but yeah.
I didn't listen to last week's show. I'm sorry. But, it was an interesting letter, and I wanted to talk about it a little bit, too. Mm-hmm. Because, it kind of, it's an interesting test as to what the boundaries are, as to what should be considered private and what needs to be known. And I think if people are, espousing white supremacy, that needs to be known, especially if they're in positions of power. But, I'd also like to know if my neighbor is a white supremacist. I think that's of interest. that could definitely come up in the future. This is something that I think is important. And I don't know, will we see more things like this? Well, I guess if people are dumb enough to do this, yeah, we will.
Also, I think in the context of something like this, like if you're putting yourself out there on a, let's say, a dating app, and the info you're putting about yourself on there is stuff you're sending over the internet about yourself, and you're ready to go out into the dating world and say, "This is, hey everyone, this is who I am." Shouldn't you be ready to back up all that same, "This is who I am," in terms of being accountable to a public who you serve?
Well, I guess we'll see now. We are going to have overtime tonight on YouTube. We haven't done that in a while. What you do is you go to youtube.com/channel2600, or just go to the link that's on the front page of 2600.com. Join us at 8 o'clock, and you can listen to us talk more and maybe even call in and have all kinds of fun in that regard. I wanted to close, though, with a couple more observations about our travel overseas. We tried, Kyle especially tried to get, the hard plastic cards that are a contactless RFID that you use to get onto buses and trains and things like that. And, we noticed in a couple of cities, in Warsaw, basically, and in Prague, you can ride mass transit for next to nothing or completely free if you are over a certain age, which I happen to be. And so it was suggested to me, particularly in Prague, that, you don't have to pay anything to ride the buses and the trams and the trains all you have to do is show your passport if you're challenged, or show your license or whatever. And that's it. So, you know, I find that very interesting that there are free buses in many parts of the world. It works. The system really works. Some cities also offer this to students. So don't tell me it can't work in New York. I think it can. It just has to be done intelligently. And it's going to be an interesting a test ahead to see if we catch up to the rest of the world. Alex, I'll let you have the last word on this because we got
to go. Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd like to say to the struggling masses contemplating the free buses out there that the, you know, the reality of the fact is, if you ride the buses like I do very often in the city, mostly nobody pays anyway. These buses, these MTA buses in Manhattan, I think maybe 85% of the people probably don't pay for them now anyway. So I doubt there'd be much of a difference to the MTA's budget, even if people started paying, or we should just make them free because they're kind of symbolic anyway.
We have to leave it there. We're going to close with a public service announcement, and we'll see you on Off the Hook Overtime at 8 o'clock on YouTube, and next week here on WBAI at 7 o'clock. Good night.
This is a public service announcement with guitar. Know your rights. All three of them. Number one, you have the right. We'll be right back.